today on Against the Grain. Is the Mediterranean Sea a place where desperate migrants fall prey to wind and water, or is it a border zone and a site of political struggle? I'm CS. Maurice Stierl talks about Europe's responsibility in relation to the mass dying at sea and about what certain activists are doing in the face of the crisis coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. When I say border zone, maybe you think of checkpoints and fences and walls. In other words, you think of land borders along which people sometimes die trying to move from one nation to another. But maritime borders also exist, with their own set of perils, and when boats capsize and migrants drown, we are tempted to attribute their deaths to the elements, to waves and water and wind, or to smugglers whose ships are sometimes built to fall apart. Today, the focus is on the Mediterranean Sea, across which more than 1 million people have recently traveled, from locations in North Africa to the shores of Greece and Italy. The mass suffering and dying in the Mediterranean and the Aegean Sea has spurred humanitarian efforts and provoked statements of compassion and concern, but none of that is enough for Maurice Stierl, who has been researching and writing about migration struggles in the Mediterranean and who is now visiting assistant professor at the University of California, Davis. The crisis, he has written, is a product of intensified border militarization by the nations of Europe that is shamelessly sold as a humanitarian rescue mission. We may view seaborne travelers to Europe as desperate, helpless victims, but they are also, Stierl argues, people engaged in political struggles that need to be acknowledged and supported. Maurice Stierl isn't just a scholar. He is active with, among other things, a hotline that responds to distress calls from migrant vessels in the Mediterranean. When Maurice Stierl joined me in studio, I asked him how many people have died or disappeared in the Mediterranean while attempting to travel to Europe over the last several years.
In the past few years, the level of death or the number of deaths has steadily increased. Up to today, this year, we have more than 2,600 deaths in the Mediterranean. Last year, we had more than 3,700. And so it has steadily increased, especially since the Arab uprisings. And the death toll over the last few decades, you know, some say it's more than 20,000 people.
And remind us where these people are coming from. In general?
So it also really depends, obviously, on the different conflicts that we are seeing in the different regions. But we have very big communities from Afghanistan, from Eritrea, from Iraq, and of course from Syria now.
And you gave me such a large number of deaths, and we're going to talk about what causes these deaths in some detail over the course of the hour. But is it at all fair to say that the Mediterranean Sea, that sea conditions are such that it would be difficult or that it is difficult for boats of a certain quality to make a successful crossing?
Yes, definitely. And we can also see that the, you know, fabric, the kind of materialities of these boats have changed over the past few years. And in many ways, this also goes together with the different interventions at sea. So, for example, a lot of boats that leave from Libya are not really intended to actually make it to, say, Lampedusa, right? Because now the presumption is that people would be picked up off the Libyan waters or outside the Libyan waters by, say, private rescue agencies, by obviously state rescue agencies or cargo vessels. So the boats become worse and worse, and obviously then the risk attached to that grow.
And what's been the response of European authorities to this loss of life in the Mediterranean Sea?
So I think what we can see now is also, again, a shift, right? So in the past few years, we've had thousands of deaths every year. So and back then, especially after the large shipwrecks of 2013 and October 2013 and the large shipwrecks of April 2015 in particular, we had responses ranging from humanitarian gestures to novel forms of deterrence. What I find really disconcerting now is that the narrative has become a narrative of silence in many ways, right? We have seen many shipwrecks over the past few days and weeks, and there has been hardly any reaction from state authorities.
Well, one big piece of news was when the EU earlier this year agreed to a deal with Turkey. It was part of an effort to keep people from traveling by boat from Turkey to Greece. Can you talk about that?
So the EU-Turkey deal falls into patterns that have emerged over the past few years where the European Union is trying to externalize its borders. What I mean by that is that other countries are now doing Europe's border work in terms of deterring migrants or, you know, imprisoning migrants so that they would not leave and move further towards Europe.
Right. And here we really have to bring up the concern in Europe among governments and authorities and many people that the continent will be overrun by people from the Middle East, from Northern Africa. How strong is that sentiment? And where does EU policy stand in relation to deterrence, maybe as compared with even last year?
Okay, so they obviously would not call it deterrence policies. They also quite often tend to wrap it in humanitarian narratives. Usually the idea of preventing deaths at sea is being used to argue for these new arrangements. So EU policy leaders say that fewer people will take to the sea, which means that there will be fewer deaths, and of course then our policy has worked. In reality, people are basically imprisoned in places they want to escape, such as Turkey, Libya. And very recently now, the EU Commission has proposed to also have a similar kind of model apply to other states, especially African states, which would imprison further populations that are seeking to leave. So these models are a response to the kind of massive migration movements to Europe in 2015, when about 1 million people are said to have crossed the sea. And of course, you know, populism is on the rise and it is a serious concern of many, but the deterrence of people and the, you know, leaving them in abject situations is definitely not the answer.
Well, what do you say to people and to governments who say that Europe cannot shoulder the influx of migrants and that if they institute a policy of welcoming migrants to the continent, then their resources, their infrastructure will be overrun?
So I think these invasion narratives are commonly employed by European policymakers and governments to, in some ways, whip up fear. And this is really a concern because in many ways we are not facing an invasion. Yes, surely we are seeing rising numbers of people moving toward Europe. But if you compare to other countries that have for many years taken in large numbers of refugees and migrants, then of course we can say that Europe, especially with its resources and its wealth, can take in many more.
Right. For example, Lebanon has something like, what, 1 to 2 million refugees from Syria and or Iraq, correct?
Yes. Surely Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon have taken in millions of people. And the kind of invasion narrative that I just mentioned seems to only apply to when it concerns European countries, right? So these countries have taken in many people for many years, and we have not really thought about it as a similar crisis in the past years, but only when it reached Europe in 2015 turned into this emergency.
What's happened to the numbers of people arriving in Italy after the EU struck this deal with Turkey?
So we can probably see and expect a shift in migration, right? This is always what people who critically engage with migration say, is that these forms of deterrence will not work in a sense that people just will not come anymore. But the issue is that people will still try to come, and they will try to do so by using ever more dangerous and lengthy and costly routes. So for example, we can see probably very soon and maybe already now a shift to, again, Libya, which is a highly unstable country, where usually in the past few years, a lot of sub-Saharan Africans traveled through. But with the shift now to the closure of the Aegean Sea, we can probably expect more Syrians to come also through Libya and other places such as Egypt.
Yeah, no question that the Aegean Sea, the route from Turkey to the Greek islands via the Aegean, was the easiest route by sea?
In many ways it was, because the distances are very short, right? So if you stand on the Turkish side, you can see the Greek island of Lesbos, for example. You can even see buildings. You know, it's a small stretch of water, but of course it is also very dangerous.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Maurice Stierl joins us. He is visiting assistant professor at the University of California, Davis, where he is a member of the Comparative Border Studies Initiative. And his research and much of his writing focuses on migration struggles in contemporary Europe and on activist interventions in the Mediterranean Sea. So part of your project, Maurice, seems to be about reimagining the sea, reimagining what the Mediterranean Sea is in particular. First, what is the conventional imaginary of the sea that you are kind of pushing back against?
Okay, so the sea now in many imaginaries has become this deadly deterrent, right? We talk about a fluid graveyard, we talk about the cemetery, which is the Mediterranean, and so on. And it has, firstly, not always been the case. And secondly, the death at sea are not natural phenomena. And that is, I think, what I find very concerning in dominant debates, that quite often the death of people is naturalized as if it was related to, say, the natural elements, right? To the waves, the winds, and so on. But of course, the Mediterranean Sea is also a very political space and has been used as a border deterrent. So I'm trying to unpack the sea and the ways in which the sea has been used by border practitioners to create a space where people drown, even if, of course, say, it is not an act of killing in most cases, but it is a form of letting die.
The conventional imaginary, as you've written about, presents a view of the sea as an untamed void, as a place that escapes human imprint. What indicates to you that this is not, in fact, the case with the Mediterranean?
So the Mediterranean Sea has become much more monitored and governed in the past few years. Also, it is frequented by commercial vessels all the time. So I think we have to move away from the idea that the sea is, as you know, Carl Schmitt maybe said, is antithetical to that of land. It is not necessarily a void, but it is a political space. It is a space that has been used for commercial exploitation and so forth.
And in the context of a discourse that, as you said, stresses how people are getting swallowed up by the Mediterranean, you know, in terms of the waves and the wind and the natural elements, in this discourse, what happens in terms of whether blame is assigned or not assigned to Europe?
What I find fascinating about the Mediterranean Sea is that the idea of blame is quite often turned into the demand for humanitarian gestures, right? So because nobody can really be blamed, you know, because it seems to be a sort of quasi-natural catastrophe that is happening, we see a lot of reactions that are formulated around the notion of humanitarianism, of course, in many ways reinforcing the duality between rescuers and those who need to be rescued, and the kind of racialization of vulnerable populations that are at sea. So what I find interesting is to think about how the sea is not only turned into a very deadly deterrent, but also how reactions then to the death is quite often framed in humanitarian ways, so that the idea of Europe as a kind of normative power, as a force for good, kind of plays into this narrative, whereas, of course, in the first place, Europe has really contributed to making that place deadly.
How so?
So we have to unpack the ways in which borders are being governed. So quite often we think about borders still in this very kind of sovereign-centric way, where borders are walls at the edges of sovereign territories. But borders have really transformed, right? They are becoming inscribed into policies. They are becoming inscribed into, for example, the global visa regime, which always already impedes various people, many people in the world from leaving or from traveling to places they would like to travel to. And we see other forms of border policies, such as bilateral agreements between member states of the European Union and, say, Libya. There was the deal between Libya and Italy until a few years ago, where Gaddafi's regime was given a lot of money to protect the European border in many ways. So we see how the borders are shifting. So we call this process the process of border externalization, border outsourcing, so that it is not only sovereign states who actually govern borders, but quite often it is international organizations. Sometimes it is even private citizens.
Yeah, and so you're right that deaths in the Mediterranean constitute border violence, which in some ways is a striking statement, but which in many ways, based on what you're saying, is an obvious assertion.
I do think that the problem at hand is not really rocket science. You know, we can really see how people use more and more dangerous paths because first land borders have been closed, because the easiest routes toward Europe are, you know, becoming more and more militarized, securitized, and so less permeable. So what it means is that people will have to make use of smugglers. And having to make use of smugglers quite often means that, you know, travel to Europe becomes more costly, which in effect also means that smuggling can turn actually into trafficking. Because if you run out of money, if you need to use kind of more and more criminal networks, then of course the vulnerability of the people increases, and then also the ways in which they may be exploited.
So we're going to talk about a number of specific events and tragedies over the course of our time together. In October 2013, a man named Mohana Jamo, correct my pronunciation please, was on a boat leaving Libya. He was among hundreds of travelers trying to cross the Mediterranean. What happened to the boat, and who did this man reach out to?
So what happened there was that the vessel left from Libya. There were more than 300 people on deck, and they entered a situation of distress. And luckily, Dr. Mohamed Jamo had a satellite phone, and he had actually saved the phone number of the MRCC Rome, which is the Maritime Rescue Coordination Center. So they called. He called them up, and he asked for obviously, quick support and a rescue operation, and was basically told to call the Maltese rescue service, because apparently, following their account, the boat was in Maltese territory. So in the aftermath, then a few hours later, there were quarrels between Italy and Malta on the question over, you know, who should actually go and rescue. The rescue was delayed by several hours, and when the rescue agencies arrived, a lot of people had drowned, and also including Dr. Jamo's two children. So it was interesting to see how, and quite horrible to see, how a delay was then also covered up afterwards. So there was no investigation. And this kind of falls into the idea of the sea as this lawless space, right? And of course, if it had happened on land, you know, when 260 people had died, and it was clear that state agency had not helped, or at least delayed rescue considerably, there would surely be an investigation.
Maurice Stierl joins us in studio. He is visiting assistant professor in cultural studies and African-American and African studies at UC Davis. And he is a member of the activist project Watch the Med Alarm Phone, which I will bring up with him very soon, and of the research collectives CritNet, MobLab, and New Keywords Collective. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So yes, this Watch the Med, as in Watch the Mediterranean, alarm phone, it was launched in October 2014 on the one-year anniversary of this shipwreck that involved Mr. Jamo and all these other travelers. Was that the main motivating factor behind this new initiative?
So the initiative arose out of outrage about what was going on, not just in this particular case, but over many, many years in the Mediterranean Sea. So we have had deaths for the last decade or so. And the idea was to really increase pressure on European border authorities to go and rescue. So this was kind of the immediate concern. But the much larger critique was, of course, to rethink the Mediterranean Sea and to make inland sea crossings unnecessary.
And who created the alarm phone and who staffs it? How does it work?
Various individuals, groups, activist communities, migrant communities kind of joined forces to launch this direct intervention at sea. Because quite often before we had organized around the issue of death at sea, but of course, you know, we always kind of came too late. People had already died at sea. So the idea was to move from an after-the-fact intervention to actually a real-time intervention and to offer a hotline, if you will, to people in distress at sea. So we have volunteers all over the place. We are now about 120 people. Many are located in Europe, in Northern Africa, also in Turkey, and some also in the US. So the phone runs 24/7, and at any moment in time, there are people behind the phone ready if we did get a call from the Mediterranean Sea. We have also a large network of supporters. We have, for example, a social media team. We have a language team. You know, of course, we cannot always have individuals behind the phone who speak 5-6 languages. So quite often, we have to pass on the phone to people who actually speak, say, Tigrinya or Farsi or Arabic.
And how do people know the number so that they call when they're in distress at sea?
So we have a very large activist network that is also situated in places where people leave from. So say in Turkey, in Morocco, in Tunisia, and Libya is not really accessible at the moment. And quite often we found that actually distributing the number via the web, via social media, is a very good way to do so. And interestingly, we have created this really large network of supporters and Syrian refugees, for example, who circulate the number amongst Syrian communities and future travelers, say through Facebook or through WhatsApp and so on. So we have these networks where the number started to circulate in 2014, and especially now after 2015, where we were involved in so many cases, the number has really been spread.
Okay, so let's say a call comes in to this alarm phone. It's called the Watch the Med alarm phone. And let's say it's a call, it's a distress call from somebody on a boat in the Mediterranean Sea. What is the standard MO? What is the approach that staffers of this hotline would use?
We created specific handbooks for the different maritime spaces in the Mediterranean Sea. So, for example, we have a handbook for the Western Mediterranean Sea telling us how to behave in distress situations between Morocco and Spain. We have similar handbooks for the spaces between Libya and Italy and between Turkey and Greece. We have these specific handbooks because the situation is always very different. You know, the sizes of boats differ. The modalities of communication differ, the languages differ because quite often there are different populations on these boats. So when a call comes in, we firstly have to establish where it comes from. And we can do that in various ways. If they have, for example, a smartphone, it is very easy to actually find out their location, you know, sending us their GPS position via Google Maps or via WhatsApp. So there are all these different technologies available. When it comes to other border regions or other maritime regions, it becomes a bit more tricky. For example, in the Western Mediterranean Sea, a lot of sub-Saharan Africans who make the journeys do not have smartphones. So they quite often have old phones, so they can actually not send us their GPS. So we try to establish where they are located by asking them where they left from, when they left from that place, and where they seek to go. In the case of Libya, it is again different because we have quite often very large vessels and people do not have smartphones, not even phones sometimes, and they would also be useless because in the central Mediterranean there's no reception. So quite often one person holds a satellite phone. And if we can get hold of a person with a satellite phone, we can actually quite easily ask for the GPS position that they can then read out to us.
So let's say you do get the fairly precise location of the boat, then what? Then what kind of aid do you mobilize in reaction to this call?
Once we have mapped the location, we look into what kind of area they are in and what state authority, for example, would be responsible in that particular area. So we have maps that show the different kind of territorial lines, the international water and the Central Mediterranean. And also we can look into other maps that exist that, for example, show the real-time movements of cargo vessels. So once we've located a boat in distress, we see who is around, who is responsible, and who would be available if we wanted to make this case public.
Well, one thing that must guide your approach, Maurice, and you are, again, an active member of this Watch the Med Alarm Phone activist project, is the inclination of various, for example, state authorities or coast guards to actually mobilize in an effective way to rescue the people who are in distress. And, you know, what do we know about how vigilant and conscientious European rescue operations are with respect to migrant vessels?
I think that also depends on the different regions and what coast guards, for example, are responsible. And so we've seen how different coast guards react differently to distress calls that we bring to them. So we've had cases where, you know, they were very keen to learn more about us and what we do and what we stand for. And in other cases, they were very dismissive. You know, they didn't want others to basically interfere in their everyday work. So for us, it's this kind of dual dimension that we see ourselves as performing, which is to, at the one hand, obviously collaborating with border authorities and coast guards so that they locate certain vessels and can go out and rescue. But we also see ourselves as a type of controller of border controllers so that I can monitor and hold accountable these coast guards, some of which have not only abandoned vessels in the past, but others have directly attacked refugee vessels and turned them back. So these are the so-called pushback mechanisms, where, for example, boats between Greece and Turkey were intercepted, sometimes still in Turkish water, or when in Greek water, were returned to Turkey, which is, of course, a huge violation of refugee rights.
Right. Aren't there international maritime conventions that supposedly protect these travelers?
Yes, there's the law of the sea, the humanitarian conventions. There are, you know, refugee conventions that, for example, prohibit refoulement, which means that someone is not allowed to be returned to a place where he or she may fear prosecution. But quite often, and that ties into this kind of imaginary of the sea as a lawless space, these regimes and these laws are quite often ignored.
Maurice Stierl is his name, S-T-I-E-R-L. He's a visiting assistant professor at the University of California, Davis, where, again, he is also a member of the Comparative Border Studies Initiative. We'll take a short break and speak more with Maurice. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Joining us in studio is Maurice Stierl. He is a visiting assistant professor in Cultural Studies and African American and African Studies at UC Davis. Before moving to the U.S., he was an early career fellow at the Institute of Advanced Study and a teacher of world politics at the University of Warwick in the U.K., and his research focuses on migration struggles in contemporary Europe, and I'm focusing with him today on a couple of articles he's written. He's written many articles about the issue of people traveling by sea to Europe in recent years. You write that the Watch the Med alarm phone, the hotline we've been talking about, is part of the Mobile Commons. What is that?
The Mobile Commons is a concept that came out of a literature that is quite often referred to as the autonomy of migration, where migration is understood as a social force. So Mobile Commons are ways in which people organize under the surface. So networks that are established by people on the move, you know, diasporas, and migrant communities that facilitate unruly movement or unauthorized movement through information exchange, knowledge exchange, through material supports, financial support.
Yeah, and this runs against this image of people as fairly well-connected and sharing information and in some sense developing an underground, I think you call it an underground world of knowledge. It stands kind of in opposition to many mainstream characterizations of these people as sort of marginal, you know, victimized and helpless.
Yes, so in my work, I also try to contest the ways in which migrant and refugees are portrayed. So quite often as vulnerable subjects, as those who need kind of our Western support, if you will. But as people who kind of find their way, right, who overcome borders, who struggle on. And so I see them as political subjects. So in my activist networks, we do not see them as helpless subjects who we, you know, support, but we see ourselves as being in solidarity with them because we see that their struggles and our struggles are interconnected.
I would think that most people who know about this situation would think of the struggles of the people trying to cross the Mediterranean as struggles of survival, and you want to call them political struggles. What's the political element here?
So sea crossings in particular are quite often thought of as, you know, these pure struggles for survival. And of course, in this situation of being at sea, it is exactly that. It is about finding ways to cross the sea, to survive the sea and not to drown. But at the same time, you know, the framing of these struggles as purely around survival quite often depoliticizes them. And what I want to do is to repoliticize them, right? To think them within a highly politicized and political context in which barriers are created against them that they had to overcome many times. So they see quite often as only one other obstacle that they seek to overcome. You know, quite often they've left places that they were not allowed to leave in the first place. They've struggled on sometimes for many years. And I was always thinking about why we cannot think about them as forms of political resistance or political struggles. Quite often the idea or the notion of resistance is, you know, always heroicized in many ways. It is very visible, whereas migration is either hyper-visibilized as, you know, the forms of invasion and the migrant tsunami, the flood, and so on, or invisibilized, right, as merely struggles for survival. So I wanted to rethink these struggles as political struggles.
You write that the Watch the Med alarm phone, that its politics is an embodiment, it's related somehow to international citizenship. By international citizenship, do you mean national citizenship expanded or supplemented?
No, I do not think that it is just, you know, the kind of traditional understanding of citizenship as we have it, so which is quite often thought of as this purely formal status that is given to someone through the state. But international citizenship is a counter-citizenship, and I relate this notion to a statement given by Michel Foucault, who called for solidarity with Vietnamese boat people who had left their country due to the conflict and the war there, and who had taken to the sea, very similar to the refugee movements that we can see today. And he called for solidarity, not for humanitarian gestures per se, right? So he talked about how, because we are all governed in some ways, we are joined in solidarity. And so this is why I want to think about international citizenship, which goes beyond the very state-centric, the very kind of settlerist frame in which citizenship is usually framed.
Yeah, and in fact, you make very clear in your writings that this alarm phone is really, I mean, it has a humanitarian effect, but it's not a primarily humanitarian project. And you've already mentioned how part of it is pressuring or bringing to light European authorities and their practices. How much of it is about movement and asserting a kind of freedom of movement that many people would wish to have but often don't?
A lot of our members come from the no borders and freedom of movement kind of context where they have struggled in various different localities and regions for the rights of refugees and migrants, the ability to cross certain borders. And I think especially in our very bordered and violent world, the call for freedom of movement is something that is not necessarily as utopian as people always think, because we see it being enacted. So I'm always interested in the ways in which this freedom of movement is actually taken. So it is not given by states, it's not given by governments, as is citizenship. It is not usually given to minority subjects, but it is taken, it is struggled for. And so is the freedom to move. And we have seen, especially in 2015, when about 1 million people, did not allow state governments and border practitioners to stop them from moving, but they've taken the right and they've found very creative ways quite often to overcome certain borders.
Getting back to the nuts and bolts, so around how many calls has the alarm phone received? And what is your sense of the degree to which it has been able to help in one way or another people in danger at sea?
I cannot quite say how many calls we've had because there were so many, but we've dealt with at least 1,600 emergency cases in the three Mediterranean regions. And our level of support has, of course, varied. Sometimes it was really just to monitor a boat that was going, say, from Turkey to Greece and ensure that the people actually arrived and were safe. And then also after arrival, that people started looking for them, because, of course, they end up quite often on islands that are not inhabited or, where no social networks and care workers are nearby. So we quite often alerted Coast Guards and local authorities to groups that were in distress even after arriving on land. So we've, I think, helped in many ways to guarantee a less dangerous journey. And quite often we've had information that state authorities did not have and that we then passed on. And obviously we insisted that they would share the steps they had taken to actually conduct rescue operations.
My name is C.S. Song, and I'm joined in studio by Maurice Stierl. He is a visiting assistant professor at UC Davis, and he is part of the Comparative Border Studies Initiative there. And he focuses a lot on migration struggles in contemporary Europe. He teaches on that topic, as well as on activist interventions in the Mediterranean Sea, of which he is a part. And we've been talking a lot about Watch the Med alarm phone. It's an activist project. It's a hotline to which Maurice contributes a lot of his time and energy. And as you said before, the hotline, the staffers at the hotline, they alert not just state authorities, but non-state operations that might be able to help with rescues. What should we know about these so-called, well, I guess some of them are called civilian fleets, right? What should we know about their prevalence and their responsiveness and why they are involved in rescuing people?
So the involvement of more and more civilian actors at sea is a very recent phenomenon. So a few years ago, the first vessel entered the Central Mediterranean Sea, which was MOAS, the migrant offshore aid station, which was initiated by an Italian-American couple that really acted on a humanitarian sentiment after, witnessing all these tragedies at sea. With them entering the sea, I think they set a sort of precedent where, they showed to people that, yes, we are civilian actors, but we can actually enter this space, which is quite often seen as, very reserved for, say, security and state actors. So Afterwards, we saw, for example, Doctors Without Borders contributing first to the MOAS mission and then also having two of their own vessels in the central Mediterranean Sea. Now we've seen other actors such as Sea-Watch, which is a private initiative which first was started by a couple of German families actually roaming the Mediterranean Sea. We see SOS Mediterranee, which is another vessel. We see the CI, yet another vessel. And some of them also have smaller interventions in the Aegean Sea as well. So we can see the kind of humanitarianization of the sea. And while I, of course, think in many ways this is great, right? Because also through the alarm phone, we quite often now have actually actors who are at sea. And sometimes we can call the crews and actually direct them to distress calls that we were alerted to or distress cases. At the same time, I see a kind of problematic dimension in it, because some of them frame their interventions purely in a humanitarian way, right? So for them, it doesn't really matter what happens to people after they have been brought to Italy, for example. But what only counts is the survival of people. And of course, this is an element of humanitarian action that we see all over the place. But what I think is concerning is the lack of kind of political engagement with the structure and conditions that actually have allowed for these, you know, quite often deadly and precarious situations in the first place. So MOAS in particular, I think, is a bit problematic, because the initial funding for this project was based on a kind of service that was offered by the initiators, which is called Tangiers Group, which is an insurance company that also insured, for example, private security people from the US going into Afghanistan and Iraq, right? So it's interesting how there is an absence or maybe a lack of engagement with structural forces that lead to migration movements. And of course, we can see that large migration movements from Iraq and Afghanistan still occur.
But might it not be true that humanitarian actors who are operating these vessels, that, you know, over time, as they understand the, say, lack of responsiveness of European, you know, coast guards or other authorities in relation to these drowning, distressed people, that's got to spur a kind of political consciousness among these people who claim to be only humanitarian or to be acting only in humanitarian ways.
Yes, I'm sure that there is the kind of possibility for like transitioning toward a more politicized stance. And I think definitely actors who've been there, you know, who have not experienced this before, in Doctors Without Borders, for example, of course, has very experienced teams, but others who maybe act on very humanitarian rationales and who are private individuals and families, I think they have also transitioned quite often after seeing what is actually going on at sea. And to also really witness how there's a lack of rescue capacity, although Europe has, you know, continuously militarized the sea. So there's a lack of rescue, although you have all these military vessels nearby. And I think through this experience, some of these humanitarians have moved beyond the rationale or, you know, the kind of pure rescue rationale toward a more politicized stance.
Okay, so let's say the alarm phone responds to a distress call, and let's say the vessel is rescued, the people on the vessel is rescued, and they actually make it to the shores of Europe. So, is the alarm phone project's role over when the traveler successfully makes the sea crossing?
So the alarm phone really focuses on facilitating these precarious movements, right? So once they've reached land, quite often we say we close the case. At the same time, you know, if we continue to be in touch with the travelers, you know, we have relationships that formed during the situation of distress and lasted after people had reached land, for example, in Greece, and then moved on via the Balkan route toward, you know, central European places. And some people actually met those that we, you know, first contacted when they were at sea. So there are these solidarities that are formed also beyond the situation of, you know, acute emergency. And what we quite often do is that when we know that they have reached land and we still have contact to them, we can pass on further information, further contacts to, say, lawyers, you know, legal support, to other networks that we know that work in the places that they have arrived and or they want to move toward. So I think there are these different networks that are overlapping quite often so that people can, you know, seek support wherever they are, even after they have crossed the sea.
And this network is really a two-way street, isn't it? You are learning from successful crossers, and you must be accumulating a certain kind of knowledge about what it takes to get across the Mediterranean and to make further journeys overland.
So the knowledges that we have accumulated through this project are immense. And what I think I need to express is that a lot of the inspirations for this project came from people who had once crossed the sea themselves, right? Also, an Eritrean priest called Father Musi Zarai, and you may have heard of him because he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2015, who had basically done the job for a decade or so, especially for Eritrean and migrants who sought to cross from Tunisia or from Libya. So he had done it, and we took inspiration from his work, and we connected with him. And we also learned from other people who had actually crossed the sea, because it is not just about, you know, learning about certain routes and so on. It is about really learning about the experience, you know, how it feels to be at sea, how a journey is organized, you know, what people have with them when they cross the sea, and, you know, how we can support them based on these different materialities and knowledges.
What about public pressure campaigns? Does the Watch the Med alarm phone engage in such activities?
Yes. So we have different sorts of public pressure campaigns. So we, when we announced our project, we made very clear also to the different coast guards that we are not just, you know, service providers. We are not just passing on information to them so that they can act on it, but we will also control them. And if we have the feeling that they do not do their best to rescue people, we've said that, yes, we would do public pressure campaigns. So we've done that a couple of times. We've also related campaigns such as, you know, Ferries Not Frontex, which is a call and also a campaign to provide for much safer ways to cross the Mediterranean Sea. We are, you know, we're involved in obviously public demonstrations and so forth. Yeah.
Frontex being the European border agency?
Yes, Frontex is the European border agency that was founded in 2004. And, you know, the budget has just become kind of out of control over the past few years. And it is a symbol for European border deterrence.
You said earlier that when the alarm phone, okay, so it hears a distress call, it gets a distress call, and then it calls maybe some kind of a state authority, and often they're kind of interested in you and what you're doing. That suggests to me that sometimes the alarm phone has actually been targeted by authorities. Is that the case?
I wouldn't say that we have been targeted so far. I think there was a concern of, you know, being criminalized, because we see how state authorities are trying to clamp down not only on illegal, so-called illegal migration, but also on those networks that support so-called illegal forms of migration. So we can see how volunteers in Greece are becoming increasingly criminalized, how volunteers in Greece have to now notify the police if they actually want to act on the Greek islands, for example. So we see how activist groups and so on are becoming governed by state authorities. Our network, I think, is not being criminalized so far. And what is interesting, actually, is that Coast Guards were very skeptical in the beginning when we called them. But of course, over the many months that we engage with them, sometimes, I don't know, 20 times a day, they now know us. So when we say we are the Watch the Met alarm phone, usually we get a very open response.
I know the alarm phone activists, the Watch the Med alarm phone activists, do not see the hotline as a solution to the crisis. What do they see? What do you see as the solution to the crisis?
So there are various short-term solutions or approaches, and then long-term ideas of how we can really deal with the situation that we are currently facing. The network, exactly as you said, does not see this alarm phone as a solution to a problem, because, of course, it's only patching up what has been created by the European border regime. So what we argue for in the long term is a de-borderization. So whereas we can see novel kind of deals with states in Africa, in Turkey and elsewhere, we argue that we have to actually do the opposite. We have to find ways to make journeys less dangerous and less deadly by creating forms of, you know, legal and safe migration routes.
And how concretely might that work?
So firstly, I think it is really important to shift the narrative, right? We have become stuck in this crisis modus of understanding migration. So everything is dealt with in an emergency modus. But of course, we are not really facing a huge humanitarian crisis per se, just because people are trying to reach Europe. But the ways in which migration paths are being deterred, you know, causes humanitarian crises to occur in the first place. Okay, so at first we have to think about very short-term solutions that are available. So of course, you know, taking in much larger numbers of people who are actually fleeing. And I do think that Europe has the space and the wealth to accommodate many, many more. And we have to shift away from the idea of, you know, people being an invasion. So these ways in which people become figures, you know, threatening individuals and so on. We have to deconstruct that. And that way we also respond to populist ideas about kind of the other that always racialize the other as a threat, you know, as a danger to Western or European ways of life and so on. So I think in terms of kind of short-term solution, we have to allow more and more people to enter the union to find safety. They're fleeing conflict, persecution, poverty, and so forth, and they have the right to find safety and protection. So that's a short-term strategy. In the long term, we have to also kind of struggle against the ways in which we kind of border the world. Right? We have to think about alternative ways of kind of living communally. And the European Union always sees itself as a force for good, an open society without internal borders. And of course, we see now that it is also a bit of a myth. But if it wants to stand up to certain norms and values that it at least declares, then I think, you know, there has to be a shift in the ways in which they deal with the issue of migration.
Maurice Stierl, STIERL, visiting assistant professor at UC Davis and a member of a number of activist projects and research collectives, including Watch the Med Alarm Phone, has written widely on migration struggles in contemporary Europe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.